The meeting will please come to order. The first item is the roll call, and may it be noted that all persons are present, all members are present. And the acceptance of the agenda, anyone have any comments, objections? I hear no objections, so I presume the agenda is accepted. Any announcements? No announcements. Well, we have a written communication from the bike. Is there someone here from the bike committee? Nobody? Well, we have this written communication. You all have it in your packet. So I guess we don't have to go through it unless somebody... You want to go? Okay, go ahead.
I just want to make a comment that I was glad to see it in our packet, so we're aware of what's going on with their meetings. I don't know. I have never seen this in before, and I would like to always see it included after they have a meeting, so we're aware of what they're doing. Just a comment.
That's, you're satisfied?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Next, we have a public comment period. Anyone in the audience who wishes to address the board may do so at this time. We generally allow 3 minutes, and any item that is not on the agenda we cannot discuss with you tonight, but we could do so at a later date. But I see no one who wants to speak, so we'll continue. The consent calendar, the minutes of the last meeting.
Be ready to run that in a month or so. That will actually be ready to start shaking it out and getting that system operational. So that was the main thing I wanted to bring attention to. That's where most of my time is going these days.
I have a question.
Of course.
Maybe we've gone over this, but what was the cost of those two new trains?
The physical cost of the trains was approximately $660,000 delivered. The installation costs are going to range around 100 and something thousand. It's all in flux right now, so my numbers are real rough. And then electrical upgrades, I would anticipate another at least 100,000 electrical upgrades in the short term, and then long term as much as $200,000 to $300,000 in electrical upgrades.
So we're talking about $1 million here for the whole project?
Yeah, total project will be over $1 million and somewhere less than 1.5.
And part of the purpose of installing it was to reduce the energy costs of the system.
Correct.
Any idea of how long it would take to pay this off in energy savings?
I haven't done the analysis of the current configuration. I did of some earlier configurations. We've kind of changed what we were doing. It'll reduce our energy consumption by about 50% and will produce twice as much water. I could do a quick analysis, but I wouldn't want to risk that off the top of my head. So I'll come back with that.
Okay. Is that only when we're using the desal facility, though?
Correct.
So that's basically state water shutdown time period.
Right now, we're currently, generally every year we use it just during the state water shutdown. The goal of putting the system is that ultimately we have this nitrate contamination issue in the Moore groundwater wells. And you go, we want to get to where we can reliably operate that system and run that system at certain times to draw down that aquifer and actually try to flush those nitrates out. So it's serving kind of multiple purposes. One, it's our peaking plant. So in the summer, if we got tight on water supply, we could run the plant. It's our plant that we depend on heavily during the state water shutdown 2 weeks or 3 weeks every fall. And then the third one is it actually gives us a methodology of trying to adapt and cope with flushing the nitrates out of the groundwater basin. So once we have that treatment capacity and capability, that coupled with we're working through renewal of our permit, our discharge permit for that plant with the regional board, and we're trying to get them to cut back a little bit on some of the testing that we have to do because we only run it very infrequently. So that first drop of water that comes out, we have to test that as if we were running the plant for the whole year. So the first drop costs you $20,000 to make. and then it gets cheaper every drop after that. But so we're trying to reduce that amount of testing. And then we also are trying to get our staff up to speed so that they can operate that plant rather than bringing in a contract operator like we do now. So if we get all of, you know, there's a lot of moving pieces right now, but if all the ducks come together, we can reduce our operating costs by about $50,000 a month for that facility, which is a substantial amount. It'll be, you know, 20% of what it once was or 30% of what it once was to run that, and then that'll enable us to run it that much more frequently.
So that cost savings would occur, it wouldn't be year-round, though, right? It would only be when we're actually
when
operating
we operate it, we
the
actually
desal.
Would, correct.
But you anticipate we'll be using it more, in part because of the nitrate flushing, so you may be actually operating it for that purpose.
Correct.
At times in the future.
Yes. You got it.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Dylan, if I could follow up on that. With you just made me think about this recharge cleaning the aquifer. How, if we're going to have those nutrients online, how are there plans? How are you going to go about doing that?
There's a lot of science and a little bit of art to it. In general terms, right now we have this aquifer and it's a shallow aquifer, so it doesn't hold a lot of water in it. The theory of the thought is that what we'll do is at times when the creek's flowing real well, so when there's a bunch of water available in the basin, a bunch of surface water available, we'll pump real heavy, and that'll pull the water level down in that basin and cause surface water to flow in there and recharge it. And so you basically create sort of an artificial drawdown and a recharge of that basin, and you're recharging it with creek water that doesn't have the high nitrates in it. So that's the thought. That you would use behind that. So you would pick times when the creek was flowing well. This time of year would be a great time to be operating it. So if we had it up and online, I would be running it right now.
And I guess the next question is, you brought up at our last meeting in terms of having staff trained to run the desal plant. Do we have someone that we're going to be training, and how much will that cost? I mean, you say we're going to save maybe $50,000 a year. And I guess with that, when it's running, it's going to be running 24/7, so we're going to have multiple months. So we'll be ahead of schedule for the state water shutdown next fall. Will we be, once we get it up and running, you'll just kind of turn it off until the fall?
Not that simple. We're approaching this almost like a design build. And so you go, I'm just doing one step at a time. The membranes shipped in December, they have a time frame where you have to be able to flush that system out. So we're in a race against the clock. If we don't get there in time, we actually ruin the equipment that we just bought. It sort of has like a shelf life to start with. So you have to flush those things out once a week. So what we're doing is we're getting it online. That'll be in the next month that we'll actually shake it out a little bit. Then the state is likely going to require us, and we're in negotiations on this right now, to do some form of operational testing to show that that plant can reliably produce what we think it can reliably produce. So they'll want to see some sort of startup, you call it startup and acceptance testing. And we'll go through and we'll test the equipment, make sure it works in all the modes and methods that we think it should work, basically prove out the manufacturer's manufacturing of the equipment, and then also test it to see that it's going to reliably work for us when we need it. Because we don't man the facility 24/7. So we want that equipment, once it's up and running and we need it to run, to work. But we're approaching this project in phases. So the first phase is to get it sort of put together, get power to it, and then get it shaken out. The other thing that we're going to do, so that'll happen, let's say April timeframe, we'll have it flushed out and ready to go. Then we're going through and we're doing a retrofit as part of this project also of the control system. And that's the control system on both the new and the old plant. And so we're tying the new and the old plants together so that it will work properly. That project probably won't be done until the fall. But in a worst-case scenario, we could actually run it by hand. We would manually turn all the valves on and off that we would need to make it work. But the goal is to actually, by this fall, have the system all integrated together, up and operational, so that I could just push a button, the plant will come on, it'll virtually run itself. It never really does, but in theory it would run itself, and then it would operate both the new and the old systems in conjunction with each other, and it would all work together. So there's a whole lot of work to do between now and then. But we're just sort of chipping away at it. First thing first, get it operational, get them flushed out, and then come back in and try to make it all work in like an auto format that's real slick and user friendly.
Anyone else? I noticed we have some pretty good potholes going. Some of the berms that have broken up will wash out if we don't fix them. And there's a beauty of a pothole in front of the post office, right next to the drop box out in the street there. It's right in the track where everybody hits it.
Yeah. City street crews can average about 3 tons of patching a week. And so we seem to generate more than 3 tons of potholes at any given time. So we're playing catch up here with our potholes, and I'll make note of...
You think you'll make it?
I don't know if we'll ever catch up with them at the current rate of pavement deterioration. But I do want to highlight a couple of things. We... use our new piece of equipment, an asphalt zipper, where we ground and reconstructed a section of Errol Street in front of Fred's Grill down to the end of Errol Street, and did about, with the contractor doing the paving, did about 180 tons of pavement. So that was a good experience for our crews in using our new piece of equipment on a lightly traveled street. So now they can take it out into the community and do a little bit more work with that. Like I said, we're doing about 3 tons a week of patching, berm repairs, and the like. Morro Bay Boulevard, Quintana Roundabout, pretty close to completed with that. We're going to have a ribbon cutting this Friday, 3 p.m., going to stage near the between the coffee shop and the Arco at 3 o'clock. There still are some remaining items to be done there. There's some cleanup items, some punch lists. There's a little drainage issue there that we need to resolve. The street lights, one of them needs to be placed, and the electrical contractor needs to do the final connections on the street lights. So we're close to being done with the roundabout. Then wanted to highlight something that didn't get put in your packets. I mentioned that we developed some door hangers that will be used as an educational tool in case there's any spills in the city streets and we cannot determine the source of those spills. We'll door hang the neighborhood to let people know we've actually influenced driver and pedestrian behavior. So I found a couple of cities that have done the pedestrian flags, and they have some evaluation forms that we can borrow from them to do a survey on that. After speaking with the city attorney, he didn't feel that it was appropriate for PWAB to approve or deny the project. It is a traffic control device, which is more of a technical, it either is or isn't allowed, so we're going to implement it as a pilot project and give it a try and see how it works and try to shake it down from there.
How long do you anticipate the pilot program to last?
I wouldn't see it any shorter than a year.
Oh, okay.
To get a full evaluation of it. Mm-hmm. When Berkeley did their pilot project, that's how long it lasted in Berkeley. They concluded that it actually didn't work for their community, that it didn't affect driver behavior, but other communities have kept the flags up, and one of the major components is in some places, is restocking the flags because they tend to disappear. And anecdotally, one traffic contractor was telling me that in Oxnard they disappear right before water skiing season because they're used as water ski warning flags. Mm-hmm. So we'll have to keep a careful eye out during the summer as summer approaches.
Thank you.
I'm wondering, is the Caltrans stop sign going to get reworked where the temporary stop sign is right now on Quintana entering Morro Bay Boulevard at the roundabout area?
The stop sign on an A-frame that's out in the middle of the intersection, that A-frame will be pulled down, and there only needs to be one stop sign there. There's a legend and a stop bar there.
Well, I figured it was there because the stop sign that's on the post now in the ground is kind of far up around the corner. So it's kind of hard to see if you don't know it's there. So I was wondering if it could get moved further out into the point of that corner.
We won't put a stop sign out into the pavement area. That's Caltrans won't allow that, but we can move it closer.
In the pavement, but it's around the bend now, and if you can bring it further back towards the point of that corner.
Yeah, we'll look at that, but there's a stop bar and a pavement legend on the ground there.
And then also, what's the plan to do about trying to get the water to stop it from washing up into the planted area in front of the ARCO?
When the project was redesigned, that driveway ended up, because the street was pushed over, ended up being flatter than a typical driveway would be, so the water tends to wash up that way. There's a couple different options that we've looked at. Ultimately, there is in our storm drain master plan, a project that will take most of that water that comes down Kern and divert it. That's the ultimate solution, is less water in that intersection. A interim fix is to put an edge drain along the backside of the ARCO driveway so that as that water comes up over, it drops into the drain and then hits that rock swale and drains out that way. That way it doesn't go through that landscaped area. Because what's happening right now is it's picking up that bark and clogging a catch basin and then creating a little lake at the easterly ARCO driveway. And one suggestion from the contractor was that we just keep an eye on it and send a guy out there to clean it out every once in a while, but that's not a good long-term solution. So we're looking at something that doesn't have to be watched all the time because we can't predict when it's going to rain. Well, we can. It's going to rain, and it'll rain at night when nobody's around, and it'll flood.
Susan, did you have something?
Jenny has one, then I have one. Hi, Rob. I have a question about the intersection at Main Street and Radcliffe. What's the status of the improvement?
There really is no updates on that status. There's a proposed project, a subdivision, up on top of the hill. As part of that development, one of the conditions will be to make some improvements to that intersection. That subdivision has slowed down in its processing, probably because of the economic times. Caltrans has evaluated that intersection. City staff has evaluated that intersection. There, at certain times of the day, there is a wait there. But it's typically
been looking at traffic calming on Main Street at that section of Main Street, which would totally remediate the problem of cars backing up Radcliffe if there were spaces.
Not really. Caltrans is not really interested in that. That's within their right of way. They have a method to fix that problem that we probably wouldn't like.
Which is?
Restricted right turn only.
Well, what about, has anyone looked at those low-lying, very wide berms, those little...
Speed humps? I don't think that's in Caltrans's toolbox there.
You mean there aren't any speed humps in California?
That would be something that they would be reluctant to approve on within their right-of-way. Because of potential for claims, their speed humps have advantages and disadvantages. If you hit them too fast, they can. People that have back injuries complain about them and file claims.
So you know what I'm talking about.
Yes, I know.
Will you explain to everyone else what a speed hump is?
A speed hump is basically something that is like a speed bump, except it's longer. And as if you go over it too fast, you have a feeling of uncomfort. So It's one of traffic calming measures. Speed bumps are another method. Those are more abrupt, generally. Narrowing the pavement width is another.
Or maybe those like bumpy bumps.
Just narrowing it so you increase. People have a tendency to not like to drive fast through narrow sections. It's called friction. So when you increase the friction on a driver, they tend to slow down. Really, if we push the safety issue with Caltrans, they have a method to fix that. Just like they did at the ramp from Main Street, it's restricted to right turn only. When we brought up that left turns may be unsafe.
Yeah, I live up there. The only reason I see it being unsafe is because of the speeding. So has that not been proposed? Is that not – that's, I guess, my question as a newbie. Has that not been a concern of the Public Works Advisory Board, that that's a chronic speeding section and a dangerous not very visible if someone's speeding down Main Street northbound underneath the Highway 1 overpass? It's fast – is that not been the concern?
The speeding issue was addressed by City Council when they brought it into the Central Traffic District and dropped the speed limit to 25 miles an hour.
Okay, it's just not being adhered to.
It's just not being adhered to, as a lot of speed limits don't get adhered to.
And it's been kind of – that just dropped at that point. But we haven't pursued –
it's not dropped. It's in a holding pattern.
Okay.
It's ultimately in the circulation element, that intersection gets realigned up to where the ramp is. The city doesn't own all the right-of-way there that would need to be done. We are hoping that the developer will assist us in the relocation of that intersection when that project moves forward.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Anyone else?
Yes. This question is for Dylan. I'm sorry I didn't jump in. I couldn't figure out how to do this microphone being new. This is back to your desal plant, your report and everything. Being somebody new to the PWAB, I was wondering if it would be possible to take a field trip of that or something for me, if I could see what it was like. And
absolutely. So there's three new members on PWAB. We haven't introduced you guys yet, but some of you have piped in a little bit as we go. And the public will get to know you. Generally what we would do, and we just didn't get to it this time before you guys had your first meeting. The timing just didn't work out. But usually we do an introduction with you. We'll bring you into the office, introduce you to the key staff members. Mostly you'll be dealing with Rob and myself. You'll get to know Mike Randall, who's presenting tonight. And then also meet Bruce and some of the other staff at the public services side. And then we give you, 15,000 pages of reading material. I don't know exactly how many it is, but it's about that much. Your 80-pound booklets is kind of what we call them. And then we'll also give you guys a tour of kind of some of the big or key facilities. We won't give you the full nuts and bolts tour, but we'll show you some of the big cool stuff. So we can certainly do that. And we'll be in touch. Rob will have, I think Christine will track you down and try to schedule that with you guys.
I have a question. Hey, Rob, this is for you. Last, talk about the fire stations, or just want a question for that? Maybe give us an update of what's going on?
Sure. Heavily we'll cover that. There's two phases on Fire Station 53, which is the one that everybody sees on Harbor Street. We're largely complete, similar to the roundabout. We're just doing some punch list and cleanup. Actually taking notice of completion to council to file next week. So in the next 2 or 3 weeks, we'll be totally done with the first phase of that, which is the apparatus bay. And if you haven't seen it, drive up Harbor Street. You can't miss it. I think it's a wonderful addition to the city, actually. I'm pretty proud of that project and how it turned out. The architects did a good job, and Bill Boucher, who I replaced, did a great job on that facility. And then now we're starting, we're going gung-ho on the second phase of that. Right now the firefighters are living in portable trailers across the street from their new equipment bay. So they got a great place to park their truck, but nowhere to sleep kind of thing. And we're working on that full speed. They actually did a tour, I believe it was today, we did a tour, and they went and visited all the fire stations in the county, the ones that they were interested in. They're really owning in on the details of the inside of this facility. So we've had the plan has gone through Planning Commission, been approved. Our precise plan is put together, so we know what the rooms are going to be. And now they're walking through and looking at things like, okay, what kind of fit and finish do we want? What kind of floors do we want to have in here? What kind of equipment as far as furniture? Do we want built-ins? Do we want modular? What colors do we like? You know, so we're getting into some of the details in that regard. So the anticipated timeline on that, my guess is that we'll go out to bid probably sometime this summer, July, August, would be my best guess at this point, and then it'll take at least a year to construct that.
Is there any danger, given the economic downturn that's hitting not necessarily just the country but our community, that will affect this building?
Building and construction phase.
You know, the City Council is working on goal setting today and yesterday. I know that this is a very high priority project for them. So I wouldn't anticipate. I know we're pursuing a loan through USDA. It sounds odd to be getting a USDA loan for a fire station, but because of our size of our community, we're small enough that they will consider us. And so we've actually are in the process of applying for a low interest loan from them for the full amount that we would need to construct the facility. And then the intent would be to pay back that debt service or loan service through the use of Measure Q funds. So as far as I'm aware, there are not any plans to scrap it. We're moving full speed ahead. And you know, when they give me a project, that's what we do. We go full speed ahead until somebody says, stop, you went too far. So we're going for it.
You have more? Go ahead.
Hi, Dylan. This is for you again. Could you just refresh my memory on the corporate yard and the expansion of the cement plant? Who owns that property? Do they lease from us on city property, or how does that setup work?
That's also not so straightforward. You'll find the issues we get into often are like that. The city corp yard is owned by the city of Morro Bay. The property that the concrete plant sits on is jointly owned property. That's owned by Morro Bay and the Cayucas Sanitary District. And that is leased back to the concrete plant operator. So as we go through this process, the concrete plant, the kind of steps I see, ultimately the goal is to rehab and realign the city yards so that's a little bit more functional. And make our operations a little bit more efficient at the city. And you go, this is a long-term thing driven largely by the fact that we anticipate when we upgrade the wastewater treatment plant that we're going to annex some of the space that's currently being used by the corp yard, and we see that as an opportunity to say, okay, well, let's think about what we're doing here. We'll realign the corp yard since it's getting partially wiped out anyways and redo it at that time. So the steps that will happen between now and then is the concrete plant is working on a modernization. I don't anticipate that that'll stop because of economics. That facility is getting near the end of its useful life. It's down there in the salt air, and things just, you know, it's nearing, they're going to lose it one of these days kind of thing. So I think that they're planning on marching ahead with that rehabilitation. Once they've figured out what they're doing, then we will have some idea of how all this puzzle pieces will start to fit together. Then we get to take that to Cayucas and negotiate with Cayucas, okay, well, who's going to lose what rents? How are we going to pay for this? If we grow into here, how much are we going to pay you for the right to do that? And it'll be a whole long series of discussions in that regard. So I see this process taking a number of years actually to get through.
Thank you.
And Dylan, I have a question about the collection system. I know Jim's here, but I don't know who wants to answer this one.
Frame and put in new. So they replaced all the structural members, repainted them, and now they're putting a new skin back on. So it'll be exactly the same building as it was before, just
without the holes.
Yeah, think of it like a facelift. So we're giving the building a facelift.
And then next, I guess, talking about lift station 2 and 3, can you explain a little bit about the, those lift stations and what's going on with them? And
happily, those are a couple of the key projects we believe to keep our collection system working great. So right now, and you'll see a little diagram of that later tonight, actually, in his presentation that shows you where and how things kind of flow. But Lift Station 2 serves most of the, what I would call the downtown area, everything from Black Hill pretty much to the power plant all runs through Lift Station 2. And that's down there on Front Street and the Embarcadero. You can't see, there's not much to see there. It's basically a buried wet well and then a buried dry well. And so if you, it's almost like being down in a submarine if you go down in there. It's about 25 feet deep, and it's actually below the water level. So it's a little scary when you're down in there and you start thinking about it. But you go, okay, the ocean's 5 feet above my head kind of thing. And you go, not a comfortable spot. So what we're doing is we're rehabbing that lift station. We're replacing it. We're getting really close. I would anticipate going out to bid on that by this summer as well. That we'll go out to bid. We're replacing the wet well will remain the same, but instead of having a dry well, which is an older style design, we're going to actually have a rail that you drop submersible pumps down in. Then if you have a problem with the pumps, you just pull them up on the rail. And that precludes you from having to send guys down into that hazardous work environment. And so that's confined space entry every time they go down there. And so we're actually going to rehab it so that when they go and do work at the lift stations, it's actually a lot safer for our operators, and it's a more efficient design. So that project will basically give us a reliable operating facility that I think we can use, you know, for the next 50 years kind of thing. And then similarly with Lift Station 3. Lift Station 3 is on the corner of Quintana and South Bay Boulevard, and that's another facility of that same design where you go, it's a little can that you crawl down into, and there are pump motors running down there that are lifting the sewage up and pushing it up Quintana. Because you kind of have that hill that breaks down Quintana, so we're pushing the sewage up that hill. That also will be, the design on that will follow Lift Station 2. So Lift Station 2 will come first. Design's largely complete. Now it's mostly staff work and really mostly my work. I've got quite a few weeks of work to basically pull it all together and get it ready to go out to bid. Lift Station 3 will fall on the heels of that. I would anticipate having that done, designed this year, and then we wouldn't go out for construction on that until after the Harbor Festival. Or, I'm sorry, on 2 we wouldn't go out. We would want to time it around the Harbor Festival. On 3, you got to be careful about groundwater levels. And so you want to pick a time of year that actually is amenable to do the construction.
No more questions.
Last month we talked about the acronyms, and I noticed they're a lot better. But I saw there were still quite a few in there that weren't written out what they meant. So, and there was one actually. I didn't just bring this up for academics, but there was one I wanted to know what it was.
Well, call me on it. Let's cover it.
Well, actually, it is under your column. It is.
Okay.
On the MTBE issue.
Yeah.
The contractor will be on site for Shell to remove the GAC system, GAC.
Yes. Granular activated carbon.
Oh, okay. So a filtering system then, basically.
Yeah, it was a filtering system. And MTBE is an acronym also. It's metal tributyl ethylene, I think, is what it stands for. I will go through this again.
Thank you.
But
I'm saying it's only for the new people, but
well,
help me as well.
And with the GAC system, actually, we'll physically remove it, so we won't have to talk about it anymore.
Oh, good. That's easy. Thank you.
Everybody satisfied? We'll move on here. I want to back up a second. I want to apologize to our new members. My intention was right off the bat at the beginning to introduce you, and I failed to do so. So on the far end, we have Richard Rutherford. Now, how long have you been in Morro Bay, sir?
You want to hit the mic, Richard?
Turn on your mic and give us.
Yeah, okay. I'm an official resident as of the 30th of December, but I've been coming here for probably the last 50 years, and with my family. We've spent a lot of time over here. So
the sanitary sewer management plan, and this we're preparing for the state board, and in compliance with one of their orders that they gave us was to prepare the SSMP, which tells basically how our system is operated and maintained. So through this process, we're kind of going through and we're recapping how our system works, how we operate it, what things we need to be doing to be in compliance with different aspects of what the state's requesting of us, and then what we want to provide to our customers. And so today we're going over the operation and maintenance program. Last time we went through the legal authority here at PWEB. This is the last section that we're giving to you guys before we take a group of them to City Council to be approved. So we're coming before you today to get this section approved to take to, or to get recommendation to be approved by the City Council in March. And there are still a few sections that will come to you guys that were listed there as well. This is kind of a schematic of how our sewer system works. Basically, what ends up happening is in each house, people flush the toilet or they run their sink, and it runs through their house lateral into our mains. And it gets eventually to our wastewater treatment plant through a variety of different ways. If they're above our wastewater treatment plant, they're able to gravity flow through our main sewer system directly to the plant. But for those locations in town, so like we were talking about before with the lift stations, that's why those are necessary, is because they're below or they're over on the other side of a hill or a high-reaching area where we can't gravity flow the sewage to the plant. So in those cases, we have to have a lift station in order to lift that sewage to the wastewater treatment plant. So we have three of those around town, and those allow us to pump the water up into a main line that takes it into the wastewater treatment plant, and then eventually through the outfall into the ocean. And so tonight we're going through how our system is operated and maintained, mainly for preventative measures so that we don't have spills and so that it remains operational. The state's required us to, for this section, to prepare collection system maps. So we have a set of maps and stuff that we'll go through here in a bit, as well as what our preventative operation and maintenance measures are for how we operate our system to keep it in a good working order. We also had to talk about how we do rehabilitation and repair projects through town, how we assess those, and what training measures we have in place, and then also what inventory and how we track all of that as well. So the first of those requirements was those city sewer maps. So the city, as sewer lines were created, some of them were drawn up and we have as-builts of the actual sewer mains that the city owns and operates. Those are located at the public services office, and we use those as records. So we have elevations of pipes. So when someone comes in and they're wanting to tie in a lateral, we can give them information on their contractor on where our main is so that they're able to access it. As well as for us, when we're doing a repair, we have detailed drawings of size, material of pipe, and basically how far we have to dig before we get to it. And those are used mainly for construction and planning type purposes, as well as lift station drawings. So we have drawings of our lift stations as they currently stand, and then eventually when we upgrade those two other ones or replace them, we'll have as-built drawings for those as well. Hand-drawn field maps are what the sewer workers use to maintain the lines and do cleaning. It's a lot easier to grasp the sewer system when you're looking at a map that doesn't have all the elevations and distances on it for cleaning purposes and kind of orientating yourself around the system. So for them, they're operating and maintaining the system, so we have those maps for them to use and use for making notes on what they're cleaning and that sort of thing. And we took those maps and to use to update our GIS, which is Geographical Information System. So that kind of gives us a database of all our sewer laterals and manholes so that we're able to know pretty much where everything is in the city in a computerized database so we can keep track of things, when it was installed, when it was maintained. And those maps are important, and we're starting to use those in the field as well because they're easy to manage and view. So for the operation and maintenance section that was in there, that's the big chunk of what you were given in the report. We broke everything down into the frequency of what the tasks were completed. And so these are preventative maintenance measures basically used in order to keep the system clear of obstructions and to evaluate any parts of the system that should be repaired or replaced. So we broke those down into daily tasks so that the operators go out and do on a daily basis, as well as monthly, annually, and then other things as they arise. And then for where we replaced an old line, an old clay line that was getting close to failure, so we did that. Training and equipment. Sewer work is somewhat of a it's a specialty, so it takes some training, and they need certification in order to do this work. The confined space entry that we were talking about earlier, the guys need to be able to be trained to safely enter the lift stations, manholes, all this stuff to do repairs, cleaning, and inspection. So the training is in order to keep those certifications as well as comply with the OSHA stuff, which is Occupational Safety and Health Administration. So to keep that stuff current and to keep the operators safe while they're out there doing their job, we make sure that, you know, we have training sessions for the guys that they're able to go to, as well as let them go to safety trainings that they feel are necessary for their job so that we can keep their certifications and keep them operating and working in a safe working environment. Then also our inventory list we're currently making because we're rehabbing the building. So before the stuff goes back into the building, we're going to make a list of it, what we have. And then that'll kind of give us an idea of what do we have that we no longer need and what do we have or what would we like to have that we don't currently have that we need in order to keep the system being maintained. So if there's some piece of equipment or there's some safety equipment that we need or that maybe not be in the best operational state, we can get new stuff and replace it. Safety equipment, we replace and inspect, so they have masks for entering confined space, for oxygen level monitoring, as well as safety harnesses for going down into manholes and lift stations. So all of that needs to be looked at on a regular basis and made sure that it's in operational condition so that we don't end up having a safety problem. That covers the safety. So I think, are there any questions on anything? I know that big chunk of operation stuff, there could be questions there, so we didn't cover it too detailed in the presentation to kind of leave it open for questions.
Mike, I have a question for the last page, contingency equipment and replacement inventories.
Yep.
On the second paragraph, power lift station pumps. These are backups that we have?
I
guess what I'm saying, are they backups at the site? Or
okay.
I think at past PWEB meeting we were talking about some of the lift stations don't have a backup there. They might have to be trucked there. Is this what we're talking
right.
about?
Right, yeah. We have pumps that are down at the – actually in the collections building for backup for those lift stations. I think we have one. Is that correct?
We actually have a number of pumps. And in this specific instance, the second paragraph, WWC also owns and operates 3 emergency generators to power lift station pumps during a power outage, as well as a bypass pump used to move wastewater. So we have 3 generators, one for each lift station. So if the power goes down, power goes out, people don't stop flushing. And so those lift stations need to stay operational. And they have a little bit of storage built into them, but we basically, if the power goes out, the guys scramble pretty quickly and get a generator there so that they can power that station and keep it functional during the power outage. And then we do have a bypass pump as well, that if the lift station caught on fire and the pumps burned up and there was nothing left kind of thing, we could go to a manhole in proximity to it or drop the pump down in the wet well and bypass the station. So that's what we were referring to.
On page 5, there's a mention here that they're talking about the mapping systems,
uh-huh.
the hand-drawn field maps.
Mm-hmm.
And it says here some portions of the sewer were built prior to incorporation of the city, and recorded information is scarce or non-existent. I was just curious what parts of the city that might include, and then how do you survey that area to determine you know, what state of repair or disrepair it's in?
You know, that's a great question. I wish I had an easy answer to that. But, you know, even with the city's been incorporated for 45 years now. Jim's been with the city 20-something years, a large number of that in collections. Occasionally, he's still surprised at something. You go, you know, sometimes when we're out there doing tests or dye tests, you go, that doesn't go where I thought that went. And then we go out and pull out the maps and go fishing for them. But we do find occasionally that there are portions of our system, mostly the older portions, a lot of that actually in the downtown area, that we don't really have reliable mapped information on. And so what you do is you train yourself and your staff as you go along to continuously collect the information that you can catch. And so you go, if somebody's doing a tie-in on a lateral, we'll go there while they have that hole dug up. We'll see how deep I'm at about my one-year mark. So we've been going at it systematically for about a year, where we started. What the city historically did was basically they would video hotspots. So they'd say, oh, something's happening here. Let's go run a video camera. Now we're getting to the point where we're actually going, we're going to start, you know, on Zanzibar and work our way all the way down through all of Morro Bay and look at absolutely every single manhole and clean out. So we've done approximately 3 out of the 12 sections. But there's a lot of data that comes out of there, and there's a fair amount of work for us to go through and catalog and prioritize that. So that's why we're going to take about 5 years to do it this first time through, because we can only keep up with so much. You go, you really, you know, there's no point having 90,000 hours of video if nobody's looking at it. And so we're trying to, you know, and we're learning a little bit that, you know, how much can we really get through and make use out of that data, and then we'll match our frequency of inspection to our ability to process it. You know, so we basically want to capture the data and then quickly process it and quickly get to those repairs or rehabilitations that are necessary or that the data shows that we need. So we're kind of we're learning as we go, but we think we can do it in about a five-year cycle.
In that process, will you determine these areas that haven't been mapped before? Will this be a pretty thorough evaluation then, which will include even those areas that you didn't have any drawings on?
Correct. And we have, for almost all of the system, we have good hand-drawn maps. So the guys that have gone through and cleaned things have drawn what they believe is there. But occasionally you find that, you know, that clean out isn't the end of the line. The line keeps on going, and you didn't know that. And you, occasionally you find you thought that lateral tied into this line, but, you know, it ran over that line and went somewhere else. And so, you know, anytime you get into buried infrastructure, and especially historically, you go, the records just aren't always as good as we would like. And so that's a continuous process. I think that's something that we'll never get past, is that we're constantly going to be collecting and improving our data collection and processing capabilities.
When I was reading this, I didn't see that a priority in repair and replacement is leakage issues. Is that just considered part of what's going to happen with our infrastructure, that there will be some leakage, or is that a rare occurrence, or is it just a priority that doesn't make it to the top because other things are more consequential?
As you go through this, the term we usually, the industry usually uses is INI, inflow and infiltration. Leakage would be what you would call exfiltration. Under most service conditions, exfiltration is not an event that's likely to occur. So when the pipe's not full, even if the pipe cracks, there are materials in the waste stream. I'm going to try to describe this as delicately as I can. So there are materials in the waste stream that will actually seal those cracks. And so you go, you don't really leak, even though you may have a somewhat cracked pipe. You, basically, the water wants to run down that flow line of that pipe. What happens, though, is if you get in a situation where you back up that line and start stacking water up in the manhole, now all of a sudden that goes from being a gravity flow pipe into becoming a pressure flow. and so you're pressurizing that. And under those scenarios, you will get leakage. But what we worry about and what we look for and what's easier to find, you know, when I'm running a camera down a pipe, I can see that there's, if there's a giant crack there, I know there's a giant crack there, and we're going to fix that. But at a joint that may be older and starting to dry out, depending on what materials they use to seal that, you wouldn't be able to visually inspect and see if that pipe was leaking out under certain conditions. But what you can look for are signs of inflow, and that's more common, that the groundwater is higher than the pipe, and so water will flow into those pipes from the ground. And we don't want that to happen because basically we're paying to treat all that groundwater, good clean groundwater. We take good clean groundwater, put it in our pipe, pump it to our treatment plant, pay to pump it there, and then treat this good clean groundwater. And you go, that's not something that you really do. So you're trying to always minimize your inflow and infiltration. And in the same problems that cause inflow and infiltration are the problems that would cause exfiltration or an outflow under certain flow conditions. So as you go through, you're looking at the defects in the pipe. The way that we rank them is you start with severity. So you're looking at severity of the defect. So you're going, oh my goodness, that pipe's totally crushed. I don't know how it's standing up. And if we don't fix that tomorrow, it could fall in, and then this whole neighborhood's going to be out of impact, major spill to the bay. That's where we're going to put our focus first. And then we'll start focusing on bad problems but less severe impacts of failure. So you go, you know, there's a cracked pipe up in the neighborhood. We're going to get to that one second. And then lastly, you'll start getting to some of the problems that we have. So we have leaky joints. We have laterals that leak. And you go, those are some of the issues that we would like to fix as well that will take care of inflow and infiltration, but they're not in danger of causing a collapse. So those would be sort of the last round of repairs that you get to. So there's a little bit of an art there, and you go, you basically capture the data, look at it, analyze, okay, what's the condition, what happens if that fails, and then you pick the worst pipe or the scariest pipe and fix that one first. And that's what we're doing.
Well, it sounds to me like exfiltration is not a primary concern because it's a rare occurrence, is what you're saying.
Correct.
And the reason I brought it up is because we have had people come to this board before with that as a concern as to our nitrate problem. So if you could just address that just a little bit more. It sounds like you really don't think that is a serious issue.
No, there's
quantity-wise, or
there's no relationship between our sewer pipes and the nitrate issue. I actually was in a meeting earlier today with a regional board, and that's their stance as well. It's very clear. The evidence is very. We've actually gotten more evidence in that the agricultural processes up in the Moro Valley are causing the nitrate issue. And it's almost physically impossible in the Moro groundwater basin for exfiltration to occur in the vicinity of the wells because of the water level is very high there. And so you go, if you dug a pit 8 feet deep, you would be hitting water well before you got to the bottom of it. And our sewer pipes are 10, 12, 15, 18 feet deep. Down through that stretch. So you go, that pipe's under 10 feet of water. So you go, and that pipe is not flowing full. And so you go, it's almost like there's no way really for water to leave that pipe. If there was a crack or a defect in that pipe, water would come in, but no water would leave. So in the Moro groundwater basin, no, it's not likely at all that exfiltration has any relationship to the nitrate issue. And then in Choro, we don't have facilities in the Choro groundwater basin. So I don't know how, you know, it would be really physical. It would violate all the laws of physics that I'm familiar with for nitrates to, you know, swim all the way out into the Choro groundwater basin.
Thank you.
This may be an odd question, but is there anything that the individual can or should not be doing to help? Is there any way to help preserve the system, or is it is what it is?
No, there are things that you can do, and I appreciate that question. I don't think that's odd at all. We actually, in the next few weeks, we're putting out a mailer about fats, oils, and grease in the home. We've talked about that in past year on PWEB. Basically, if you flush grease down your line, you know, if you're cleaning the dishes and you got, let's say you cooked 100 pounds of bacon and you had a nice thick layer of grease, you know, it, one, you're asking for a heart attack, but two, think of that clogging the arteries, that same thing happens in a sewer pipe. And you go, that grease gets in there and basically clogs up the sewer pipe, and then it can actually stop flow and cause it to back up into your home or into your neighbor's home. So we always encourage people to dispose of fats, oils, and grease in the trash can, not down the drain line. There are other things that you can do that are just almost to be courteous to our workers. You know, there are certain things like dental floss. A lot of people will just flush dental floss not thinking about it. But if you've ever had to pull a 10-pound ball of dental floss out of a pump, you almost want to stop flossing. It becomes an annoyance to you. And so you go, there are certain things, you know, your toilet is not a trash can. And so we encourage everybody just basically to take that as the mantra, and that'll be the best advice I could give anybody is put trash in the trash and use your wastewater system for what it's designed for, which is wastewater.
What about some of these toilet bowl cleaners or stuff like that?
Most of, if it's designed as a toilet bowl cleaner, most of the cleaning products that you would routinely use in your home are not going to be a problem. If you got rid of solvents and certain paints and different kind of things like that, it potentially could be. So those materials we would say use in the household hazardous waste. The lines that we largely have in Morro Bay are clay pipe. The good thing about clay pipe is it's highly chemically inert. So it's pretty immune to chemical attack, but not real good if the dirt starts moving. So there are certain damages that are going to occur to a pipe in the ground. The tree roots grow.
I'll make the motion that we forward this report on to City Council as it is.
I second that.
Okay. Any questions or comments? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you.
Because I think we're on to we're going to do the trees.
You want to back on something?
No, I can see Dylan wants to skedaddle. I wonder, can we? I had a question about putting something on a future agenda, and I don't want to go too. Is it all right if I ask a question real quick?
Well, that's okay. Go ahead.
Okay, this question is about San Jacinto Street in North Morro Bay. It was talking about, it was brought to my attention, how do we go about putting on the agenda, or does PWAB even entertain this, about talking about some sort of further traffic mitigation on San Jacinto?
Dangerous territory is what I'll say to that one, as I look to Rob. We actually have been directed by council not to entertain an intersection improvement there. So we can't, staff can't bring that back to council.
Okay, so that means then that if a citizen of Morro Bay has an issue or a complaint, they need to go to the full city council.
Yeah, that's as good a spot as any.
That would be, or they could come to this board as a public forum and address it here. I don't think I'd have to review the council action, but I don't think we're prohibited from talking about intersection improvements. I think it's a certain type of intersection improvement that we're not discussing.
So then as PWAB, can I, when we get to future agenda items, do I bring up that I would like to put on the agenda to speak about traffic, further traffic mitigation on San Jacinto? Is that how that would go?
Basically, I think that could be a PWAB action item. So that would be for example, like this current item, a PWAB board member initiated item for discussion. You might take action on that and send a memo to council.
Okay. Thank you. I just wanted to catch Dylan before you leave. See where
no
we
problem.
Put that on the agenda. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Now we'll continue with the The item B under new business, the formation of a tree subcommittee. And this is, I'll turn it over to June Christoph Jones here.
Thank you. Did everybody read the staff report? Okay. Do you have any questions? I don't want to reiterate what's already in
right.
there, so...
My one question, it says to contact Bill Woodson, mm-hmm. and that was sort of the first mention of him, so I just kind of want to know what his position in the committee is.
Bill Woodson is on our planning commission, and I mentioned in the report there was an ad hoc committee. It was Noah Smuckler, myself, and Bill Woodson, and we all thought that it would be a good idea to have some type of a formal tree committee for the city. And trees fall under the PWAB's jurisdiction, but we didn't think it was appropriate to have all the details of tree planting, tree selection, tree events have to go through this whole organization. So, and there are a lot of people that are interested in trees specifically, so we thought it would be a good idea to have a separate subcommittee that would come to PWAB and bring forth their information. The Adopt a Tree Committee was active in the 90s, as I mentioned, and people were very excited about it. We still have quite a few trees planted during that time, but then it kind of just died away. And so that's what we initially started talking about, was getting the Adopt-a-Tree program going again. And that's what this last attachment was here. Oh, yeah. Yes, this one, the Adopt-a-Tree program. That was just our rough ideas on how we wanted to set the program up for the Adopt-a-Tree. The Adopt-a-Tree would be coordinated by the tree committee. The tree committee would not only oversee the Adopt-a-Tree which will all come back to PWAB, and then we can decide if we agree with where they're going, what they're doing, and then pass it on to City Council for further action if needed. I did bring on the trees on Quintana Avenue. We had some tags made up, and this was Bill Woodson's work. Mm-hmm. So if you did adopt a tree, there will be one of these labels put on the tree to identify it. It doesn't have your name on it, but it just says, it does. Kind of look, think of it. It's this one would have been on a Cub Scout Pack 214's tree. And then, as described here, the responsibility is basically to water in that tree for 2 years on a twice a month basis until the tree is well established. And the trees would be chosen from a master tree list, which already exists. And so that's how the Adopt-a-Tree fits into the bigger picture. The tree committee would also like to make sure that we meet all the requirements for the Tree City USA designation, which we do have. And I know we just got some publicity because, again, we've renewed that for another year. We have met all the requirements. Someone asked me earlier what those requirements are to be a Tree City USA, so I thought I'd just mention those real quick. There's four basic requirements. One is you have to have a tree border department, so that's kind of fallen under the public services heading in the past, but we thought it'd be good to have a specific tree committee that just to really focus in on our tree and our urban forests, our trees. And by the way, we're really looking at street trees. We're not talking about privately owned trees. That's a whole separate setup. The second standard is that there is a community tree ordinance, which we do have. It's also referenced there. And one of the things that ordinance says is that the city takes out a tree because it's dead or it's a danger in the public right-of-way, that tree should be replaced. And in the recent past, that hasn't been able to happen because the city really hasn't had the funding to do that. So we'd like to help generate some funds to make sure that continues to happen. This third standard was a community forestry program with an annual budget of at least $2 per capita. So that's what $20,000 per year is supposed to be in the city budget to cover costs and that's a minimum. And then the fourth standard is an Arbor Day observance and proclamation. And we're thinking maybe the Adopt a Tree kickoff activity could become an Arbor Day event. So those are the four requirements to be a Tree City USA, which we already meet, but we could probably just do it even better than we have been.
Your requirement one here, mm-hmm. the tree board, this PWAB actually is that, because mm-hmm. PWAB was formed as from three former city boards, one of which was a Street and Trees Committee. So that's already in here.
Oh, thank you. I don't have that history like you do.
Well, anyway, but so. Now, do you want to proceed to form a subcommittee
that,
tonight?
That will, yes, that's what I'd like to make a recommendation that we do. Do you have another question?
You can.
Susan? I think Susan's got a question mm-hmm. first.
Yes, I just want to volunteer for the tree subcommittee.
Oh, great. I'm glad to
hear that. And also ask if everyone's aware that there is a large tree planting event going on this Saturday at down by the power plant.
Thank you for bringing
yes.
that up.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. What is that?
It was in Noah Smuckler's newsletter, and they're planting trees down by the power plant.
9 to 1, I believe, on Saturday.
Yes, 9 to 1 on Saturday, and they were asking for volunteers. And there's a lot of flags down there that I've already seen, and I'm not sure if those are related to where the trees were going to be placed or not. But it's this Saturday down by the power plant, and it looks like an exciting thing. I'm assuming they're not taking out any trees there because that's a large nesting area there.
I only know what you know because I read it in the newsletter, too. But it's not a city event. It's done through a private organization, okay. correct? But if people wanted to know more, Noah Smuckler would have
it was
the
on
details.
His newsletter,
mm-hmm.
yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there's one other thing maybe I should bring up just for further information for the public that's watching. Could I? Yeah. I can't. Thank you. Can't locate mine now. The Adopt a Tree program that we got going last November. And please, everyone, go by and take a look at our trees. They're looking pretty good. We have Catalina Ironwoods, oaks, and the third tree is, the strawberry tree. Right. Where's the strawberry tree? That's what we chose to put along that corridor because it's very windy, and those are very hardy trees, and they are, I believe all of them native trees, too, so they're well-adapted. For the city, then it's $275 donation minimum there, but you also do get a permanent plaque in the ground that will stay with that tree. So those were the three levels of sponsorship, and Bill Woodson would be the person to contact if you're watching and you'd like to get going on something like this. His number is 772-0494. And he is part of Morro Bay Beautiful, and he's one of our city planners. So,
would you say that number again?
Sure, I'm sorry. Bill Woodson at 772-0494. Better? You're welcome. We hope to hear from many of you.
Okay, so, do we have anyone else who wants to be on this subcommittee? We need three people.
Well,
we have
actually,
two already.
We have nine people already on.
But I mean, from our.
We don't need three.
Well, we don't.
Mm-mm. We need at least one person from PWAB.
Okay.
Which
well, we've already got
I've
two.
Already, yeah, right. So
yeah.
That's great.
Okay.
That's great.
So
we have a list of nine people,
right.
And we don't want the committee any bigger than that. But if there are other people watching that would like to be involved, again, call Bill Woodson. The list that we have of nine people was taken last December, and we don't know that everyone's still interested. And also whether or not they'd really be willing to make the commitment of a meeting once a month, which is what we anticipate it'll be a 1 to 2 hour meeting once a month to get this going at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Rob, do you have anything you'd like to add?
I just wanted to add that on March 9th, as City Council, we'll be bringing to Council a resolution for their support to the Adopt a Tree program, and that might be the appropriate time to forward this recommendation on to them to actually get their support in the formation of this tree subcommittee with that Adopt a Tree item, bringing it at the same time.
Okay, so we want a recommendation from the board here to pass this on.
That would be great. And then we can include that recommendation along with the staff report prepared and with our staff report supporting the Adopt-a-Tree program and supporting the formation of this tree subcommittee.
Okay, can I have a motion to that effect in which we include the memorandum and the fact that we appoint a subcommittee and the two people that are on it and recommend that the council proceed as Rob outlined? Or is, should we adopt what you said as a motion?
I think you could adopt your motion and then just recommend that that go on to City Council, and the appropriate time that that would be going on to City Council would be at the March 9th meeting when we have another tree item going there.
Okay.
Okay. Well, I'd like to make a motion then that PWAB approve a formation of a Morro Bay Tree Committee to act as a subcommittee to PWAB, and that we would like that recommendation to go forward on the March 9th agenda of the City Council meeting.
I second it.
Okay. Any further comments? Any?
Did you want to add in your motion that appointing two board members to staff that committee at this time?
Let's do that as a separate item. The council doesn't have to be involved with
okay.
that.
Okay.
So, I would say if we're going to... we should finish that motion, though, shouldn't we? Okay. So I made a motion. You seconded?
I did second it.
Motion's here. Any other comments?
I just want to say best of luck. Yeah.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Pass unanimously. Then I'd like a second motion. We form a subcommittee with June and Susan as members from PWAB.
I think maybe it'd be better, since we hope this committee will be far-reaching into the future, as long as the city's here, I hope, that we make it a more general statement, that we say we have to have a minimum of at least one, or we could say two PWAB members on the tree subcommittee.
You know, we can go three. We can't go four because it can be a quorum.
Right. So I think we should just pick a minimum number because we could always have more. Yes.
Just for the sake of future PWAB members that may or may not be interested in this, mm-hmm. I mean, they should. I mean, or they probably would, being on this board. One would be a safe number, and then if there's more, there's more.
I make a motion that there be a minimum of one PWAB member, but no more than three PWAB members on this subcommittee.
I second that.
No,
I would like to get this item, an item placed on future PWAB agenda that I guess we discuss the San Jacinto Street and various traffic mitigations that can slow traffic there, especially in the mornings when kids are going to school, the posted. And so is that enough, Rob, or what should I say?
I think that's enough for an agenda item. I think you could probably prepare a minimal staff report for your discussion and just have it as a board discussion item.
So I'd like to put on the future agenda item that we discuss, that PWAB discusses the San Jacinto traffic mitigation and have staff report applicable information that goes, historical information that goes along with that.
Okay. Matt, I have a question for you. I'm assuming you're talking about the intersection of Main and Highway 1 in San Jacinto.
Actually, I'm talking from the intersection of coming off the highway and Main Street all the way up to Ironwood.
Yeah.
Thoroughfare, it becomes very much of a speeding trap. I mean, kind of what...
With kids crossing.
kind of what Jenny was talking about. I mean, not necessarily because I don't think Caltrans is involved on San Jacinto Street there, so I think it'd be a city issue. But in the mornings, that becomes an issue for kids and families and cars going across from whatever street across San Jacinto to go to Del Mar. And I know cars, when they come off of Ironwood down San Jacinto to the highway, it's no holds barred. Some, I know the speed limit is 25, but it's very often more.
I'd like to expand that discussion to include that whole length of San Jacinto, but also if we're going to be talking about, talk about the intersection at Main and San Jacinto, because I also feel like that is an area that doesn't work very well, even in low traffic flow periods.
Okay, and then anyone else have any future agenda items to suggest in addition to the two that are listed under item 11?
I just have a question on the last item. When did you want that on the agenda? And just to be clear that one of the PWAB board members is preparing a brief report regarding that. That's not a city staff item since it's not on our work plan at this point in time.
So you're saying that a PWAB member would have to accumulate that information to be presented? Or, and then also, when can we put it? Can we put it for the next meeting or the next maybe two?
More likely April.
Yes, we have the Brown Act workshop next month, although we do have an early start time for that Brown Act workshop for 5 o'clock is proposed for.
We might.
I'm not sure how much data you would need to really accumulate for that staff report. We have traffic counts that I can get you for that intersection. They're probably 10 years old now, but probably not a whole lot of changes in traffic count since Morro Bay hasn't changed a whole lot in the last 10 years population-wise. So we can get that data. I think it's probably more important that the discussion that ensues out of that topic.
Okay.
So then I would be fine, then, since we're doing the Brown Act next time, so that would be April, I'd be fine putting it on the April agenda.
Yeah. Okay. And if something else important comes up for next month, we could probably add that on in as much as the Brown Act thing is early.
The only other item that should be on next month is elections for chair and vice chair.
Yeah, that'll be on there. All right. Okay, is that it then for the future agenda items? And if nothing else?
I have one question for Rob on the Brown Act workshop. Will that be recorded and televised?
It'll be a irregular meeting, basically. So,
oh, okay. So it's just going to start an hour early.
You just start an hour early.
Okay, I didn't understand.
Our city attorney has requested an early start time.
Okay, got it. So it will be televised as usual?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
So that the March meeting will be at 5 p.m., 1 hour earlier than normal, because the city attorney will give us a report on the Brown Act. So, anyway, anything else? Then we stand adjourned.